The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle, Disc 3.
Chapter 9. For 3 more days we drifted upon the glassy sea. The helplessness of it, I could tell, drove Captain Jaggery nearly to distraction. Though the sun grew fiercer, he kept sending the men out in jolly boats to tow the Seahawk for 2 hours at a time in search of wind. He found only more to complain about. And then it happened. It was late afternoon, 18 days into our voyage, the first dog watch. I was on the forecastle deck with Ewing. Ewing was a young blonde Scot, handsome, I thought, with a shocking tattoo of a mermaid upon his arm. That, and his Aberdeen sweetheart, about whom he loved to talk, fascinated me. I rather fancied sweetheart and mermaid were one. At the time, he was sitting cross-legged, quite exhausted. That morning, the captain had ordered him to spend the day in the highest reaches of the yards, putting new tar on the stays. The sun was brutal. The tar was sticky. Now an old canvas jacket lay in his lap, and with trembling fingers he was attempting to patch it, using needle and awl. While he labored, I read to him from one of my favorite books, Blind Barbara Ann, A Tale of Loving Poverty. He was listening intently when his needle snapped in two. He swore, hastily apologized for cursing in my presence, then cast about for a new needle. When he couldn't find one, he murmured something about having to get another from his box in the forecastle, and made to heave himself up. Knowing how tired he was, I asked, "Can I get it for you?" "It would be a particular kindness, Miss Doyle," he answered. "My legs being terrible stiff today." "Where should I look?" I asked. "Beneath my hammock, in the topmost part of my chest," he said, "in the forecastle." "Will someone be able to point it out?" "I should think so," he said. Without much thought, other than that I wished to do the man a kindness, I turned and hurried away. I had scampered down the forecastle entryway before pausing to think. The forecastle was one of the few areas I had not been in before, the one place on the Seahawk that the sailors called their own. Not even Captain Jaggery ventured there. No one had ever said I was not to go, but I assumed I would not be welcome. With this reservation in mind, I hurried to the galley in hopes of finding Zachariah. I would ask him to fetch the needle. The galley, however, was deserted. Since I did not wish to disappoint Ewing, I decided I must go and fetch the needle myself. Timidly, I approached the forecastle door. As I did, I heard muted voices from within. Indeed, it was only because they were vague and indistinct that I found myself straining to listen. And what I heard was this:
"I say I'll be the one to give the word, and none other. It had better be soon. Jaggery's pushing us hard. How many names do we have?" "There's 7 that's put down their mark, but there's others inclined."
"What about Johnson?"
"It doesn't look right. He's not got the spirit."
"It won't do. He needs to be with us or not. No halfway. And I don't like that girl always spying.
Her being here isn't anyone's fault. We tried. You remind yourself we kept those other passengers off."
I heard these words, spoken by at least 4 voices, but I did not at the moment fully grasp their meaning. Understanding would come later. Instead, I was caught up in embarrassment that I should be eavesdropping where I hardly belonged. It was not a very ladylike thing to do. Yet I was, in part, the subject of their conversation. And the errand was still to be done. Wanting to do what I'd promised, I knocked upon the door. Sudden silence. Then,
"Who's there?"
"Miss Doyle, please." Another pause.
"What do you want?"
came a demand. "It's for Mr. Ewing," I returned. "He sent me for a needle." There was some muttering, swearing, then,
"All right, a moment."
I heard rustling, the sound of people moving. Then the door was pushed open. Fisk looked out. He was a very large man, lantern-jawed, his fists clenched more often than not, as though perpetually prepared to brawl. "What do you say?" he demanded. "Mr. Ewing wants a needle from his chest," I said meekly. He glowered.
"Come along, then,"
he said, waving me in. I stepped forward and looked about. The only light came from the open door, just enough for me to see that the low ceiling was festooned with dirty garments. I was accosted by a heavy stench of sweat and filth. Scraps of cheap pictures, some of a scandalous nature, were nailed here and there to the walls in aimless fashion. Cups, shoes, belaying pins, all lay jumbled in heaps. In the center of the floor was a trunk on which sat a crude checkerboard, itself partly covered with a sheet of paper. Along the walls hammocks were slung, but so low I could not see the faces of those in them. What I did see were the arms and legs of three men. They seemed to be asleep, though I knew that could not be true. I had heard more than one voice.
"Mr. Ewing's chest is there,"
Fisk said, gesturing to a corner with a thumb. He lumbered back to his hammock, sat in it, and, though he said no more, watched me suspiciously. The small wooden chest was tucked under one of the empty hammocks. Apprehensively, I knelt, briefly turning to Fisk to make sure that this chest was indeed Ewing's. He grunted an affirmation. Then I turned back, drew the small trunk forward, and flipped open the top. The first thing that met my eyes was a pistol. The sight of it was so startling that all I could do was stare. One thought filled my mind. Captain Jaggery had told me, bragged to me, that there were no firearms anywhere on board but in his cabinet. My eyes shifted. I saw a piece of cork into which some needles were stuck. I pulled one out and hastily shut the chest in hopes that no one else had seen what I had. Then I came to my feet and turned to leave. Fisk was looking hard at me. I forced myself to return his gaze, hoping I was not revealing anything of my feelings. Then I started out, but in my haste stumbled into the trunk in the center of the area. The sheet of paper fluttered to the floor. Apologetic, I stooped to gather it, and in a glance saw that on the paper two circles had been drawn, one inside the other, and there appeared to be names and marks written between the lines. The instant I saw it, I knew what it was. A round robin. Clumsily, I pushed the paper away, murmured a thank you, then fled. I was trembling when I left the forecastle. To make matters worse, the first person I saw was the second mate, Mr. Keach, who was passing on his way to the galley. I stopped short, with what was, no doubt, a guilty cast to my face. Fortunately, he paid no attention to me, giving me hardly a look beyond his normal nervous frown. Then he continued on. But though he was gone, I simply stood there, not knowing what to think or do. Unconsciously, I clasped my hand, jabbing my palm with the needle. Ever faithful to my sense of duty, even in that moment of crisis, I hurried to Ewing and gave the needle to him. "Here, miss," he said, scrutinizing my face as he took it. "Have you taken ill?"
"No, thank you," I whispered, attempting to avoid his look. "I am fine." I fled hastily back to my cabin and secured the door behind me. Once alone, I climbed atop my bed and flung myself down, then gave myself over entirely to the question of what I should do. You will understand that there was no doubt in my mind regarding what I had seen. There had been a pistol. There had been a round robin. With the warnings given to me by Captain Jaggery, and ever mindful of the possibilities revealed to me by Zachariah, I had little doubt about the meaning of my discoveries. The crew was preparing a rebellion. Regaining some degree of calmness, I thought over who it was that had been in the forecastle. To begin with, there was Fisk. He was part of Mr. Keach's watch, so it was reasonable to assume that the other members of his watch were with him. There were, I knew, 4 men in that watch. Ewing, Morgan, Foley, and, of course, Fisk himself. But as I reviewed these names, my feelings of puzzlement grew. What I had observed did not make sense. Then I grasped it. I had seen Fisk. It was he who had opened the forecastle door, and Ewing was on the forecastle deck. But when I stepped inside, there had been 3 hammocks occupied with men. In short, I had seen a total of 5 men off watch. Assuming the other hammocks indeed held members of the watch, who then was the 5th man? Could it have been Mr. Keach himself? No. I had seen him just outside the forecastle when I emerged. Nor could it have been someone who was on duty. The captain would never have tolerated that. Who, then, was that 5th man? I began to wonder if I'd not been mistaken about the number, reminding myself that a hammock full of clothing would have looked much the same as one occupied by a man. But the more I recollected what I'd seen, the weight of the hammocks, the dangling arms and legs, the more convinced I grew that I'd indeed seen 4 men. Suddenly, like the crack of a wind-whipped sail, I recalled my dim vision when waiting to board the Seahawk the night of my arrival, of a man hauling himself up ropes to the ship. Of course! A stowaway! But where could such a man have hidden himself? No sooner did I ask myself that than I remembered the face which had so frightened me in the top cargo when I'd gone for my clothing. It had been a face that I'd not recognized. Indeed, it was just that lack of recognition that convinced me I'd imagined it. In fact, I now realized, I must have seen the stowaway. No wonder I did not recognize him. He had been hiding in the hold, which explained Barlow's dire words about the place, as well as the grinning carving. The man sought to scare me from the place. But having arrived at that conclusion, I asked myself this. What was I to do with my discovery? To ask the question was to have the answer. Captain Jaggery. It was to him I owed my allegiance, by custom, by habit, by law. To him I must speak. And the truth was, in addition to everything else, I was now consumed by guilt and terror that I had not told him before of the incident in the top cargo. So it was that by the time I had come full course in my thinking, I knew I mustn't wait a moment longer. I needed to get to Captain Jaggery. Recollecting the time, 3 bells of the 2nd dog watch, I knew that the captain would most likely be found by the helm. Nervously, I emerged from my cabin and went on to the deck in search of him. The 1st man I saw was Morgan, leaning against the starboard rail. He was a gangly, long-limbed, muscular fellow, with a fierce mustache and long hair. As he was one of Mr. Keach's watch, not currently on duty, he should have been among those in a forecastle hammock when I'd been there. I say he should have been, because I'd not seen his face. His presence was only a surmise. But there he was, on deck. Brought to a dead stop, I gazed dumbly at him. He, in return, gazed right at me. Surely, I thought, he was there to observe me. For that long moment we stood looking at one another. I saw no emotion on his face. But what he did next left me with little doubt as to his real intentions. He lifted a hand, extended a stiletto-like forefinger, and drew it across his own neck as if cutting it. A spasm of horror shot through me. He was, in the crudest way, warning me about what might happen to me if I took my discovery to the captain. For a moment more, I remained rooted to the spot. Then I turned to lean upon the portside topgallant rail and stared out over the ocean, trying to recover my breath. When I had sufficiently steadied my nerves, I turned back cautiously. Morgan was gone. But he had achieved his purpose. I was twice as frightened as I'd been when first I stepped upon the Seahawk. Anxiously, I glanced about to see if I was being watched by anyone else. Sure enough, now it was Foley whom I spied atop the forecastle. He was busily splicing a rope. At least, that's what he seemed to be doing. The instant I saw him, he looked up and pinioned me with a gaze of blatant scrutiny. Then, quickly, he shifted his eyes away. He, too, was spying on me. Completely unnerved, I retreated to my cabin and bolted the door. The warnings had an effect quite opposite to what was doubtless intended. More terrified than ever, I now felt that the only person who could help me was Captain Jaggery. But so fearful was I of going on deck in search of him, I decided to wait in his cabin till he returned, certain that the crew would not dare to pursue me there. Cautiously, I pulled the door open again, poked my head out, and when I saw, to my relief, no one was nearby, I rushed to the captain's door, and out of a habit of politeness, knocked. To my indescribable relief, I heard, "Come in." I flung the door open. Captain Jaggery was looking over some charts. Mr. Hollybrass was at his side. The captain turned about. "Miss Doyle?" he said politely. "Is there something I can do for you?" "Please, sir. I was finding it difficult to breathe. I should like a private word." He looked at me quizzically. I had not come to him in agitation before.
"Is it important?"
"I think so, sir. Perhaps it can wait until—" No doubt it was the distraught expression on my face. He changed his mind. "Come in and shut the door," he said, his manner becoming alert. Mr. Hollybrass made a move to go. The captain reached out to restrain him.
"Do you have any objections to Mr. Hollybrass being here?"
he asked. "I don't know, sir."
"Very well, he shall stay. There's no one I trust more. Now then, Miss Doyle, step forward and say what's troubling you."
I nodded, but could only gulp like a fish out of water.
"Miss Doyle, if you have something of importance to tell me, speak it."
I lifted my eyes. The captain was studying me with great intensity. In a flash, I recollected a time when my much-loved brother broke a rare vase, and I, out of a high sense of duty, told on him, despite what I knew would be my father's certain fury. "I was fetching a needle for Mr. Ewing," I got out.
"A needle," he returned, somewhat deflated. Then he asked, "Where did you find it?"
"In the forecastle."
"The forecastle?" he echoed, trying to prime my tongue. "Is it your habit to frequent that place, Miss Doyle?"
"Never before, sir."
"What happened when you went there?"
I saw a pistol."
"Did you?"
I nodded.
"Where exactly?"
I glanced around. Mr. Hollybrass's normally red face had gone to the pallor of wet salt, whereas the captain was suddenly flushed with excitement. "Must I say, sir?"
"Of course you must, Miss Doyle. Where did you see the pistol?"
"In Mr. Ewing's chest, sir."
"Mr. Ewing's chest," the captain repeated,
exchanging a glance with the first mate as if to affirm something. Then the captain turned back to me.
"Anything else?"
I bit my lip.
"There is more, isn't there?"
he said. "Yes, sir."
"Out with it."
I could not speak.
"A what, Miss Doyle?"
"A round robin."
Now it was the captain who gasped. "A round robin?" he exclaimed. "Are you quite sure?"
"Just as you showed me, sir. I'm certain of it."
"Describe it."
"I did."
"And there were names written in, were there?"
"And marks, yes, sir."
"How many?"
"I'm not certain. Perhaps 5, 6.
"6!" the captain shouted with a darting glance at Mr. Hollybrass. "I wonder it's not 9. Could you see whose names they were?"
"No, sir." I'm not certain I believe you,
he snapped.
It's true, I cried, and to prove my honesty, I hurriedly gave him an account of my experiences in the top cargo, as well as my conclusion that the ship carried a stowaway. By the time I was done, he was seething.
Why the devil did you not tell me before?
He demanded. I didn't trust my own senses, sir.
After all I have done for...
He failed to finish the sentence. Instead, he growled,
"So be it,"
and said no more before turning from me and pacing away, leaving both Mr. Hollybrass and me to watch.
Mr. Hollybrass,
he said finally.
Sir? Call all hands. Sir, what do you intend to do?
I intend to crush this mutiny before it starts.